This evening I'm going to reflect on the Ten Paramis. But first I'd like to start with a little bit of perspective that allows for us to hear the teachings, the reflections, in a manner that actually has a little bit of order to it. Because I can remember that the extraordinary sense of gratitude that I felt after I'd been practicing a while, and first in Zen, and trained in Zen, and very grateful for that, and then the transition of my practice, the Vipassana practice. And along came Upandita to IMS, and in a series of Dhamma talks that he gave in retreat, I just had this experience one evening of, oh, I see how it all works together. Because my mind had this, you know, piece over here and this piece over there, and it was a kind of fragmented sense of the Buddhist teachings, Buddha Dhamma, and associated practices. So just to offer a little bit of perspective that might help us to see how it all works together. Buddhism is a practice-oriented doctrine. There isn't an ideological framework. It is very practical because it has all to do with this term bhavana or cultivation, and it is the response to that awakening sense in the heart of intentionality. And the actualities or the principles that are present in the teachings are something that actually become apparent to us, one of which is, for instance, the actuality of change. The difference between the agreement that we have, you know, that the only constant is change, and the actuality of this of anicca is that we learn to work with change. We begin to work with impermanence rather than work against it. And as a result of that, there is this gradual transition in our orientation. And our orientation, according to the Buddha's wisdom, that we bring into our practice is based on what is referred to as the root cause of suffering, which is ignorance of craving. The ignorance of the sense of self and this kind of egocentricity that's built up over time, where everything is self-referenced, right? Without any real sense of underlying cause and effect. So it says that as the intentional, as the intentionality strengthens and then meets with mindfulness and begins, and therefore to cultivate present time awareness, then there's a slow transition from egocentricity and self-referencing to the development of qualities. And these qualities are all responses and aspects, responses to and aspects associated with a very core principle in the Buddhist view, which is ahimsa or non-harming. And so it's always helpful to understand this. And then in reading the teachings, we see that what it is that the Buddha repeats over and over and over again is that what can be known is the distinction between that which is harming and that which is freeing. That which is harming is binding, and that which is freeing is unbinding. So I'd like to suggest that as I reflect on the paramis this evening, that we keep in mind the fact that this is a practical orientation. Everything that I'm going to be speaking about can be practiced, can be cultivated. And as well, everything that can be cultivated can as well be applied. And that it is all organized around this principle of ahimsa, non-harming, in conjunction with the first noble truth of suffering. We begin to see how suffering and the causes and effects associated with the roots of suffering actually cause harm. I hope that's clear. So the paramis oftentimes overlooked are actually very central to this theme of non-harming, very specific to this, the fact that as intentional beings in the Buddhist practice, we become students of the First Noble Truth. We become interested in suffering. And we also become interested in what supports this unbinding, what is wholesome. I'd like to give a little bit of history on the paramis. Upon awakening in Zen Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, the Buddha reflected that the culmination of the complete and absolute clarification and purification of mind came about as the result of the certain factors that were kept in mind and throughout time. And the story associated with that was also told, and it's a part of the Buddhist mythology, and that is that in the past, there was a hermit who had a moment of great faith, an aspiration, an insight that it was possible to recognize suffering and to bring it to cessation, and that that was something that was a potential in all being, all humans, and as the Buddha speaks often, all devas. And so this hermit, this aspirant, went to the Buddha of antiquity at the time. The name of the Buddha was the Buddha of Light. And my DDDs are getting lost. Deepankara, I believe. Can anybody?
Deep means light.
Yeah. So, okay, Deepankara. And said that I've had this experience of a faith and a glimpse of what is possible, and am interested in responding to this, no matter how long it takes. But I want to check with you, Buddha, Buddha of Light, whether or not there is truth in this or whether there's delusion. And so Deepankara confirmed that this was a true aspiration. And if this were to be something that motivated his process throughout time, throughout all of time, that the culmination would give rise to a Buddha. He didn't say, you are going to be a Buddha. He acknowledged that there was a process that he could attend to over time that would then carry over in terms of inspiration and aspiration that would give a way to cultivation that would take all of time that would then culminate in what we call Buddha. And so he said, and now go to the forests and contemplate the means that will guide this process. And so in contemplation, he recognized what's referred to in the Theravadin, specific to Theravadin teachings, the 10 paramis, 10 qualities, 10 virtues that he would cultivate, or that the consciousness, the Bodhisattva consciousness, would keep in mind and bring to fruition. And this is how it is that they came to be known as paramis, because if we look at the etymology of the word, param-a is basically the highest or the most excellent, the most far-reaching. And ita is arriving or going or having gone is transcendence. And there's a little chant that comes with me from the Zen training that goes, Angate, Gate, Padasam Gate, 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 Paragate, Padasam Gate, Bodhi Swaha, Gate, Gate, Padasam, Paragate, Padasam Gate, Bodhiswaha. And this is gate, gate, gone, gone, complete, fulfilled. Having brought this process to fruition, parami, perfection. And it's a reference to particularly the paramita of wisdom, prajna paramita. Everything having matured and brought to fruition, to culmination in the form of a Buddha, a mind that is incapable of harm, a mind that is completely, completely free of any taint of greed, ill will, or delusion. Delusion, I underscore. And so we understand through this that there are these qualities that are actually inherent to our nature. It isn't like we have to go out and find them on retreat, you know. It's the fact that they are actually already awakened to some degree within our consciousness, within our mind stream, but not necessarily having yet arisen in mindful awareness, because the indicator in arising factors in mindful awareness is again this term bhavana, where one can bring attention to and manifest these qualities. And this is the way that we evaluate our practice over time in terms of the maturation of these qualities. There's no hierarchy. There's no one who becomes anything. It's more that we attend to that which has value. We attend to that which is unbinding. And as a result of that, mindfulness sets the course, sets the compass, so that we have a sense of path that brings this into consciousness. And then as a result of that, we engage and mature these qualities over time. And therefore, this is the bodhisattva instinct. The mindfulness, or sati, is that factor that renders the heart open to its inherent tenderness and sensitivity. It heightens sensitivity so that as a result of that, there is access to a sensibility associated with that sense of path, that sense of the compass that we hold that allows for us to know the way. And as we know, as our practice grows, we realize that the knowing of the way is associated with it actually occurring right here. Right here. And so right here, we can probably feel the resonance of this list of 10 qualities that I'm going to read. And even though the clock is going quickly, I will read these slowly. The first, something that we hear a great deal about, the first training, the first hearing of the Dhamma that we can apply is generosity. And the action is giving, and the practice is relinquishing. I'm just going to read them and then I'll come back to them. They're so inspiring. So, first of all, generosity. And we know that as a force within ourselves. These are forces of purification and clarification. As well, virtue. And I will reflect on virtue in terms of what the Buddhist ethics are and how they reflect and support our experience of this deepening sensitivity and sensibility. As well, renunciation. And I'll reflect upon that in a way that might be more helpful having to do with the development of volitionary restraint. Wisdom. Panya, that knowing factor, the knowing itself, the knowing of the sensation, you know, the knowing of the knowing factor that gives rise to wisdom, which is able to discern and so to speak, see the distinctions between and amongst, and therefore to bring clarity. Energy I'll reflect on as strength. And Kanti, or patience, which is, I'm in awe with patience, is power. It's referred to as a power. I'll reflect on this. And truthfulness, truth / fullness. And as well, resolve, or better understood in terms of patient persevering, that quickens into a concentration in the form of resolve. Not a willful factor, but born of willingness. I'll hope to reflect on this a little bit. And then, of course, our precious loving kindness, metta. Metta. And the tenth is equanimity, or upeka, the ability to see along with things as they are. Equanimity, the balancing factor. So just quickly again, generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truth, fullness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity are these inherent qualities that are maturing right here in this very moment as we listen to the nutrient of Dhamma. So, generosity, as was mentioned, is often taught first, and in fact in Asia it may be the only parami that's taught, because it said it has such value. It breaks down the sort of boundary between self and other, because as the inclination towards relinquishing, towards giving arises, then there's a sense that giving is receiving. And that in that, there's a glimpse of the potential for unbinding. And as the greed factor relaxes, then this generosity culminates in ways that allow for the other factors having to do with the potential for awakening from suffering to come into maturation. I recently picked it up because there was a difficult situation in my family. And so I was just curious, if I reflect on these 10 qualities, what will the view be as a result of this? If I reflect on Dana, on generosity, and so forth, how will that shift the view, shift the perspective? What is it that I will cultivate as a result of this that will bring about a helpful, wise, wholesome response to this difficulty? So generosity, although we think of it as maybe just dropping a couple of dollars over there, you know, it's suggested that it has such a power within our awakening process that if we understood the extent of its power, that we would never share, we would never have a meal without sharing it with someone. And when I first heard this, I remembered a family that I used to have a meal with occasionally, you know, that the great fun of spending the night with a friend. And they always had a setting at the table with an empty chair. Sometimes it was full, but most of the time it was empty. And I finally, when I felt comfortable, asked, why do you have this empty chair? And they said, for somebody that we may have the good fortune of sharing our meal with. And it's that, of course, later became confirmed as an aspect of this power of sharing. And it's more sharing than it is giving. And it's more relinquishing than it is sharing, because we begin to recognize over time our own good fortune, our own good fortune. And so generosity is associated both with the sense that giving is receiving and the glimpse in terms of its power, and therefore allows for the increasing sense of being guided by this, and the lessening sense of acquisition. That delusion that somehow I am becoming and I am getting begins to soften a little bit. The I, born of craving, thinks that its role is to get and become. And of course, what it's supposed to get is pleasant, right? Virtue. Virtue is basically a quality. It's not about right or wrong. It's easier to understand virtue through the five precepts. It's easier to understand that because of our association with morality, a code of conduct, a way that one should be, that then is informed by the result of how what will happen if one isn't the way one should be. And so it's very dualistic. And of course, we all come to the practice with some sense that if I'm good, I will get this, and if I'm bad, I will get this. And somebody was reflecting in an interview that she had discovered that if she isn't constantly worried and thinking about what she can do for others, that she will go to hell. And so I said, well, what would that be like? And so we looked into the belief together. And she said, well, she it would be being chained, being confined, it would be fire. And so she's beginning to see that there's a relaxation of that belief. Because it said at first that our process is motivated by that sense that we want to be safe. We want to be safe. We have, of course, in our practice, the precepts. And the precepts are associated with non-harming, and they're not mandates. They're not dictated to us. There's no threat that comes with them. They are not meant to instill fear, but to support discernment. And, of course, our precepts are refraining from causing harm to any living being. And sometimes that's expressed in the furthest extreme, which is to kill, to refrain from harming, to refrain, to look at the impulse to take that which is not one's own, to consider the actuality of the factor of sexuality is something very basic to our nature, and to respect it and to bring it into awareness and to begin to look at it with a kind of reverence, a sacredness that might protect us from misusing that very primitive impulse to procreate and the pleasure in it, momentary pleasure. As well, to begin to consider the process of deviating from truth or altering truth as a way to get a certain outcome, and to become more familiar with this inclination. This is about becoming familiar with these impulses that betray our a mindful intention to cultivate an unobstructed life. And of course, intoxication. And that's a very beautiful contemplation over time. What is it? And as we see into habits that take form, that give form in our character, and and how it is that we look towards pleasure to intoxicate ourselves as a way not to experience the other two experiences of life, which are that which is unpleasant and that which is neutral. We begin to see the ways that we actually create our own delusion. So these five precepts are the supports for a contemplative ethical framework where we take them into consideration to see if they are helpful and how they are helpful. A little bit about each. We could have a week on each if you would like. See, that would be 10 weeks. So that would be 2 month retreat and a half. Right? Something like that. Renunciation. Of course, we hear renunciation, we think that means taking robes, stepping away from life, disengaging. And we hear a lot about this in the more archaic translations, where what we do is we close or guard our sense doors. It's quite extreme sometimes in the Theravada monastic view, where there's actually, just to be open about it, a view that women are the daughters of Mara, that women by our very nature are seductive, because what we do is we as objects that are seen and heard and so forth stimulate the impulse towards reproductivity. Procreation, and so therefore Theravadan monks are not allowed to be in the same space with a female without another male. This is how tender we are. This is how strong the base impulses are, and how confusing they are. But actually, in a more lay appreciation of bringing everything into awareness, we're looking directly at it rather than ignoring it. And I'm not saying that all monks are ignoring this impulse, because they are working with it very directly. There are practices within the many, many, many precepts that are associated with that that have to do with respecting and bringing it to a more calm awareness. So this isn't about either or. But the renunciation, that sense of moving away from life, is actually about coming more into an awareness of the relational actuality of life. That in the depth of our own practice, we are cultivating that which then comes into manifestation in relationship with others. And this is understood through the nuanced translation of sati, which is participatory awareness. So one begins to develop what's referred to as a volitional restraint out of interest, not out of suppression. One begins to become interested in what it is that drives the beast, and also what transforms it into a conscious way of being, and as well what brings about this clarification and purification and potential transcendence, that it's not about getting away from anything or getting rid of anything, but developing an all-inclusive appreciation of the potential for freedom that comes through our being open to that which is suffering within us. Wisdom. Wisdom is the knowing factor, as I mentioned. Wisdom isn't something that we become. It isn't a quality of personality. It's more understood as clarity. And in our experience of our practice, I'll just speak about it very, very simply. That which knows the sensations arising within the process of breathing is the knowing. And knowing is purified consciousness. And its functionary is wisdom. And according to the wisdom of the Buddha, that which can be known, the essence of the knowing, is the knowing of the distinction between that which is harming and that which is not. Not from a place of judgment, but just the knowing itself. And already within our own experience, we've had that sense of knowing of that distinction. And therefore, we have our wisdom practice, our vipassana practice. And as well, we have the cultivation of certain factors within our wisdom practice. Then, as I mentioned earlier, all of these qualities can be practiced. So this is how we can understand that we keep the Dhamma in mind throughout time. Energy. Energy is something that is very fragmented. We experience that. We experience it in terms of the stress and chaos that we experience in our minds and bodies. And one of the reasons that we begin to become more familiar with a different range of energy in our practice is because of the fact that as we begin to practice, energy becomes reallocated and directed towards the cultivation of that which is wholesome through mindfulness. The tendency for our attentional factor, to get lost and caught up in confusion and in, within the complete obscuration of any objective awareness, knowing, for instance, that when we oftentimes will wake up in the morning and we're feeling kind of grumpy, that if there's a sense that this energy, these sensations in the body are associated with this state, then somehow it's more manageable. We can bring calm to the energy. We may not be able to get rid of the energy. The process of change isn't about getting rid of anything, but we can, in becoming more and more familiar in mindfulness, in returning to this foundation here, become aware through the knowing of what all these various states and the energies associated with all these states that are part of our sense of being bound are indicate. We can see them individually. We begin to recognize what they are. And this brings about a lot of inner spaciousness. So that our energy begins to flow in the direction of cultivation. I see it sometimes like a hose. Unconsciously, attention goes into the subconscious process that's driven by factors that we can't even identify. You know, we just feel haunted and agitated and irritated and victimized by it. And then over time, through mindfulness, this energy becomes reallocated through cultivation. And instead of our attention going into the subliminal level, into the dark battlefield of our inner experience, our dualistic experience, the energy flows into mindfulness. And this occurs just through the simple returning and aligning intention with attention in the clarity of, okay, as an example, what is it that's being experienced in this moment? Well, it's painful. Okay, just knowing that it's painful then becomes that it is unpleasant. Okay, just knowing that it's unpleasant, just the knowing itself opens up the space for the body to be able to breathe, to be unbound, for a little bit of spaciousness and calm arise. And this is how it's understood that these factors help to mature the inclination of mind towards that which allows for this body to breathe. I've been referring to my practice as a living, breathing practice of late. That distinction between that which unbinds the capacity to breathe and that which binds it, to be able to breathe in the heart. So energy moves towards that which is wholesome. It's said that that which is wholesome predominates over that which is unwholesome. Patience, Kanti. Patience is power, it said. It's a power because it works to open rather than to close. It's not acquiescing patience. It's that one gives something the space or the time, all the time it needs to unfold. And it's very strongly aligned with our growing sense of working with change, because everything has a beginning, middle, and end. And patience allows for that fullness of experience, the fullness of the experience of one inhalation, exhalation, the expansion of the mind and the heart that allows for one to counteract agitation and that sense of hurry, 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 that is so much a part of our culture, but it's also just a part of the delusionary process. There's no time, delusion says. And there is time. Patience opens up our sense of time to include, and as a practice, to be able to counteract, counterbalance agitation and restlessness and anger. Truthfulness. Truth, what is it? Well, it's what we can know in this moment. And there's a very poignant story where when Raula was told by his mother that the Buddha was approaching and that the Buddha was his father, she said, "Now go and claim your inheritance. Demand it." And so he did so. "My mother says for me to claim my inheritance." And he said, "Your inheritance is the Dhamma, that which has the highest value. And the merits within the heart of this child open in understanding." And so he joined his father as a member of his assembly. And the first interchange between the two of them was about truthfulness. That by all means, and honor this as your one contemplation. Because by knowing the truth, whether it be momentary or not, then you are basically protecting yourself at the very most basic level from the engagement of all the other forces of suffering, greed and ill will. This will mature into the dispelling of delusion. I wish we had more time to talk about truth, but that will be Sunday if you're interested in coming and reflecting on these qualities, whereas Saturday we'll be cultivating them. And then resolve. Resolve is, again, actually opens through willingness as opposed to willfulness, engages patience in a way that steadies the mind into a persevering receptivity. A persevering receptivity. The steadiness, the knowing and the receiving of that which is in this moment occurring. And that's just so poetic to kind of still our minds for a moment as we begin to recognize the role of resolve in our practice, perseverance, loving kindness, that tenderness of heart that responds to mindfulness, that opens and by its own warmth, melts away the fear that obstructs this deep sensitivity, this tenderness that we are, that is the access to this sensitivity and, as I mentioned earlier, an aspects of intelligence that we cannot otherwise mature in our consciousness. We think of it as maybe a sweetness, but actually, not just is it sweet by nature, it is also fierce by nature. It has great strength as it conjoins with panya, with wisdom, and then the next with equanimity. It's not about being sweet. It's about the force of kindness that becomes an aspect of our intelligence. Equanimity, upeka, seeing along with things as they are, is, it said, arises at the first moment of mindfulness and is the factor that continues to mature, that actually, it said, then brings about the purest sati, So it's basically equanimity maturing through mindfulness that then galvanizes all of these qualities that I've been reflecting upon and brings them into culmination. And therefore we have the story of the last watch of the night of the Buddha, where Mara appeared, the manifestation of all greed and ill will and delusion. I once had a picture of a painting of Mara. I wish I still had it, because you go, oh, you know, that's what this looks like when I'm angry. You know, it was so clear, you know, looking into the face of this artful representation of Mara, that when Mara arose, not just Mara, but with legions, all the expressions of greed, of will, and delusion that exist. And the Buddha recognized them all for what they were, saw that they were empty, and they disappeared. This is the role of equanimity. The emptiness that exists within the stillness, in this receptivity, that mobilizes all of these qualities and brings them into culmination through isness, is what is true, foundationally true, and is the refuge of truth in this moment, is that my body is sitting here and that there is knowing within this that can now be present and cultivated within the experience of this one inhalation, this one exhalation. And becoming the Raulo wanted his inheritance, inheriting all of the beauty that exists within our hearts, that reflects the fact that Dhamma exists within every moment and every movement of life that's occurring right here in this moment, within this body sitting here, as we form the clarity of intention to cultivate these inherent qualities to fruition. Perhaps we could sit together for a moment in a recognition of the fact that we have extraordinary good fortune that will emerge and manifest through our practice in these 10 qualities.